here's a couple facts we all must consider. First, farming is mentally and physically demanding. No doubt about that, right? Second, our farmers now average 58 years of age. Wow. With these two figures in mind, we simply must pause to ask, when our farmers age out, and our farmers are aging out, who among our young will step up to grow our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 991st edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Dave, how are you doing today?
Glad to be here.
I have a question for you, Dave.
Uh-oh.
When you look out, do you see any young folks getting ready to step into the farmer's boots and farm our food?
No. It's kind of alarming.
Oh. Well, folks, I had a recent conversation with one of the nation's premier food processors. This man's family has been processing raw crop commodities from area farmers into value-added food products in the same location for well over 100 years. You would know his name were you to see it on a label in a grocery store anywhere in the United States. We talked about the new ways of growing crops for a while, and he was animated with the dollars and cents possibilities of the new technology. And we talked about which elements of the new technology he would encourage his farmers to adapt. Then our conversation came to the farmers who grow crops for him. On the tips of his fingers, he began ticking off the names of the farm families his family has worked with for generations. And then he said, in a sad amazement, not one of these families have children to take over their farms. Were this conversation a one-of, it would not be worthy of mention, much less consideration. But it is not a one-of, it is one of many of taking place across the nation. Farming is an occupation that is both mentally and physically demanding, and our farmers now average 58 years of age. When we put hard work together with aging farmers, we simply know things are going to change, and they're going to change really quickly here. So today we pause to ask, who among our young will step up to grow our food? Here to help us search for an answer, we have Lauren Markham, who is the author of The New Farmers, which is an article posted in Orion Magazine. You can read it yourself. Just go to orionmagazine.com and it's there. Lauren, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're an independent writer based out of Berkeley, California.
That's right.
Farms in Berkeley?
You know, we actually do have quite a few urban agriculture initiatives springing up in Berkeley, but there are not a number of commercial farms.
Okay, fair enough. What inspired you to develop this magazine article on the new farmers?
It really came from personal experience, and having increasingly, I'm about 10 years out of college and increasingly post-college, I've been seeing a lot of my friends go into the farming business and become farmers themselves, either as apprentice farmers or increasingly as we're growing up, owning and operating their own farms. And that seemed to be surprising to me because folks in my older cousin's generation and in my parents' generation, that was not happening among many college educated or, you know, folks with master's degrees. That was not happening among their friends or their communities. And it was happening increasingly in mine.
So you see well-educated young folks with college degrees going into farming?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, and that's part of what this article sort of explores, but increasingly folks are going into this, it appears, for various reasons. One, it appears because of lifestyle choices, wanting to have a lifestyle that is not a typical grind that we're so used to, wanting to have a lifestyle that is not strapped to technology and is not this sort of frenetic, fast-paced existence. Also, it's out of an environmental ethic, wanting to really see, you know, our generation is strapped with this incredible problem that the generations before us have left us with, which is that the earth is changing rapidly and in very scary ways, and we have to do something about that. And I think increasingly, and this is sort of what the article focuses on, is that farming is this environmental activism. It's environmental activism at your own hands. And so folks are going into this to make change, not just demand change, but actually make change through their farming practices.
Good to go. And you brought us another guest. Who did you bring us with to join us today here on the Food Chain?
We have Eliza here, Eliza Greenman.
Hello, Eliza. Are you there?
I'm here. It's great to be here.
Right. And where is here? At least, where is your here?
I'm currently in southwestern Virginia in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains. And you are the proprietor of a small farm as well, right?
Well, I'm leasing land on a small farm, but I'm owner of a small fruit tree nursery on that farm.
Okay, Legacy Fruit?
That's right.
Now, have you ever worked with a professor of Apple, Tom Burford?
Tom and I have had a few shenanigans here and there, and I certainly value the work you've done, and he's somebody I look up to.
Good. I had him on the Food Chain a few weeks ago, and we talked about the Red Delicious apple. So an interesting character Tom Burford is, for sure. So you're out there in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. You have a small fruit tree nursery, which, of course, means that you're the one that starts things out for other farmers. And Laura, you said that she's part of an organization that starts other farmers, too, right?
Yeah, so Eliza, we'd love to hear you talk about the Greenhorns and the Young Agrarian Network and your involvement.
Sure. So I work with the Greenhorns, which is a young farmer advocacy organization that's basically there to support, recruit, and keep happy the droves of young people who are moving towards agriculture these days. And we're heavily based in media. So we have documentaries that we've produced. We have a weekly podcast that's on the Heritage Radio Network. And we also start all sorts of things like the Agrarian Trust. And we write a Farmer's Almanac that's a biennial, you know, production. So, we're here to support and sort of just connect young farmers across the country because we're an organization of young farmers.
Well, Eliza, now, were you a young farmer growing up?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you grew up on
a
farm?
Not. Actually, no, I'm sorry. I did not grow up on a farm. But I was sort of a free-range child.
Okay.
Who grew up witnessing other farmers and actually grew up in a fishing community. So
That's kind of agriculture, my way of thinking, anyway. Good. Well, Eliza, then, what was the moment, you know, that you, when you look back, you decided, I'm going to take this world into my own two hands and go to work?
Well, it really started when I worked at a small mom-and-pop corner store in my neighborhood, selling bait, tackle, and ice cream, essentially. And the old crusty fishermen would come in and tell me stories about how fishing ain't like it used to be. And over time, I started to learn that it was because of a declining fishery and us taking more and not putting anything back. And so that sort of set the tone for me in my quest to learn how to balance life and farming and nature in one.
Eliza, Lauren talks about how she saw so many of her friends, well-educated young people with college degrees, becoming farmers and becoming farm apprentices, becoming farmers, starting to put their time and talents at risk in the business of farming. Do you see the same phenomenon as well? Or let me ask you this. Do you see any children of farmers farming?
Oh, I I don't know of many people farming, young people farming, who are from farming families. I have run across a few who in Maine, where I was part of the Maine Organic Farmer and Gardener Association's Apprenticeship and Journey Person Program. They have a really great network of young farmers across the state. And so I did run across some in the rural areas. And
so, so it was almost like you had to have a microscope and you're running around looking for them to be able to find them. So that's our first question of the day. What on earth is happening to our farm families, our farmers, their children? Where are they going? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're asking a big question, ladies and gentlemen. Who is going to step into the boots of our farmers to grow our food? Where are they going to come from? Here to help us answer that question, we have Lauren Markham, who is the author of The New Farmers in Orion Magazine. Pick up a copy, or you can just go to orionmagazine.org. And we have Eliza Greenman, author of what's the name of it? Greenhorns. Okay, right back. Do stay tuned.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5, 6, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, here's a trend to consider. The average age of the American farmer is now 58 years old and growing older as we speak. The number of farms in the United States shrinking from 2007 to 2012 down 4%. Wow. Gone. Just like that. The value of farmland in the United States from 1997 to 2012 up 400%. The size of farms, bigger and bigger and bigger. So, in looking at this, we wonder who's going to step into the shoes of those aging farmers as they age out of the business. Somebody has to take care of the business of growing our food. Well, who is that going to be? Lauren Markham, who is the author of The New Farmers in Orion Magazine, you picked up this notion of the new farmers, but when you were looking at the story of the new farmers, did you cue in on the story of the aging farmers?
I did. Yeah, I absolutely did. And, you know, I should say that my family, on my mom's side, she comes from an agricultural background, and one of my dearest aunts is a cattle rancher. So I have some family background in the farming business and in aging farmers. And so I looked at that more on a statistical level than I did. I didn't interview a number of mm-hmm. aging farmers beyond, you know, my own family. But that's definitely like a driving factor of the story and of the central question of where are these new farmers coming from and sort of why and what does that mean in the larger kind of context of the U.S.
Eliza, what about you and the greenhorns? You look out there in the world and you see a population of aging farmers. And as you mentioned earlier, you're not seeing children of those aging farmers stepping into the boots. Was that an issue to you? Do you see that as kind of like a looming storm cloud on the horizon?
For me in particularly, I'm a perennial farmer, so I grow things that won't bear for 3 to 5 years.
Right.
And so I find that age group as being, it's really lonely out in this world of being a perennial farmer. But I do see on the annual side of things, and even the livestock side of things, that there are a lot of young people who are stepping up to the plate, and that's really reassuring to see.
But what about the aging farmers themselves? Is that a big issue then in general in agriculture across the country?
Oh, of course. And it's an issue as well in the amount of information that needs to be passed on to the younger farmer generation. Most of us young farmers there's a gap in generation. Our parents' age did not go into farming, and so it's the grandparents' age that has a lot of knowledge. And so we're finding that even that gap in generation is really there's kind of a code that needs to be cracked for communication, because young farmers these days are communicating on sort of different levels with social media, with cell phones. It's different. And so there are some challenges involved, but we're working through them.
Well, Lauren, you ended the New Farmers article with a very poignant story. I hate to start in the middle with something that was in an end, but it was so appropriate when Eliza's talking about this gap in knowledge. So tell us the story about the little girl in the pasture.
Okay. So when I was in college, my boyfriend at the time, his older sister, owned a farm, you know, a couple miles down the road from me, Blue Ledge Farm, an incredible goat dairy, and that's been growing and blossoming over the years. It's an incredible place. And I loved getting to spend time there. It was Hannah and Greg who ran that farm were the first sort of, this was, you know, it's kind of interesting because this article actually kind of, I think, was born back then, really, because they were the first people I knew who were, you know, a little bit older than me who were choosing farming, who they didn't come from a long legacy of farmers in recent years. And so we would spend a lot of time on their farm. And the story that I sort of end with is that now they have two kids, but at the time they had a little girl and a daughter named Livia. And Livia was just this total farm kid. And it was so I was sort of simultaneously watching her parents kind of owning this farm, operating this farm, choosing this life, and then watching them raise their daughter, who was being raised so differently than I was and had this completely kind of whole relationship to the landscape around her, that she wasn't sort of intellectually learning this. She was experiencing this, and she was growing up in this. And one day we sort of went out on a walk in the pasture, and there was a goat had died, and they were getting ready to bury this goat, and she came across this goat, and she sort of, you know, and I sort of thought, oh my gosh, this is horrifying. This poor little girl is going to see this dead creature, and I'm, you know, there's death, and how do I explain this to a child? And I was having this sort of meltdown in my head about this moment of death, and she just sort of nudged this goat and said, you know, it's dead. And then we turned back around, and it just struck me that she had this really beautiful relationship to the natural world and was so much more prepared for the world and so much more in tune with the natural cycles than I was by far. And that was really incredible to see.
Eliza, you were talking kind of like the missing link. Is that kind of what you're talking about, that innate knowledge of life and life's processes that comes next, you know, with a business of agriculture, and is not taught, or probably can't be taught in public schools in the city? Is that kind of where you were going with that?
Yeah, there really is a gap in just awareness of where food comes from, and that has to do, I think, with the gap in generations. Many people who left the farm didn't impart this knowledge, the farm knowledge, into their children. And so we're kind of in a reawakening phase, the young farmer movement.
And that's a significant one, because how do you learn that? Lauren, you were talking about the juxtaposition of the parents who are intellectually coming to grips with all of this life stuff on a farm, and the child who is growing up with it and kicks a dead goat and says, it's dead, and that's that. How do you make that transition when you're the one that's trying to become intellectually familiar with this?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak from my own experience, because, you know, I was sort of having the most removed and intellectual kind of reckoning with this whole thing, because I wasn't, you know, I would visit the farm all the time, and I sort of loved this. It was this like amazing novelty down the road, where I sort of got to parachute into this incredible life, and I had this total fascination with their life, and loved the thing. You know, I loved cleaning out the milk house with them. I loved feeding the baby goats, and it felt like it was helping me develop a more whole relationship to the landscape around me and to the economy around me. And but it wasn't, I wasn't actually like involved in those natural rhythms. I was just sort of like going there and sort of like, you know, slightly active observer, not even that active. And what was, you know, I think what was fascinating to me about the child is that it wasn't an intellectual experience, right? It wasn't, it was just this natural part of her upbringing and her life. And so the hopeful part of that, I think, is that, as more, and you know, I hope that as young farmers sort of take up this work, if they are raising their children on farms or in farms, you know, I also hope that these children will sort of be just like the child I mentioned, that they will have this better relationship to landscape and this more complete, not learned, you know, like experiential relationship. And I also think that, you know, I have so many friends who are farmers. I am not a farmer, but I hope that my children will spend a fair amount of time on farms, you know. And I know I grew up going to my aunt's farm, and that was an incredibly poignant and important experience for me.
Eliza, do you think that can be taught in city schools? And in a public school setting, do you think that you can teach a child those life processes like that are just naturally taught on the farm?
I do think so. And it's all about exposure. There are a lot of, well, you mentioned specifically city farms, and there are a lot of urban farming endeavors that are happening all over the place.
Okay, can you hold that? We're stuck on a hard break here at the bottom, so we're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, today we're talking about who is going to pick up the business of growing our food for us. You're invited to participate. 800-624-2665, 831-4798. Who is going to grow our food? Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're looking at the future of our food and asking who is going to step into the boots of our aging farmers and grow our food. Kind of scary if you think about it. 58 years of age, the average age of our farmers across the country. Their farmland is getting more and more expensive, making it harder and harder for young farmers to step into that land and take it over. And so how's this going to work? We have to have somebody to grow our foods, right? Or maybe not. Maybe it'll all be produced by a big machine and packaged in brilliantly colored wrapping and sitting on the grocer's shelf that'll last for like 30 years or something like that. Lauren Markham, do you see that in our future?
I certainly hope not. But I've reported substantially in the Central Valley in Fresno and the big industrial farms, and it's definitely there is sort of a post-apocalyptic or a pre-apocalyptic sense of that world. But
what do you mean?
You see a lot of machines doing work down there. You see the food. There's a lot of food waste. There's a lot of food going to waste because of the factory farms can only pick at certain times. And so ripe fruit, actually, they can't. So there's just like carpets of food going to waste. There are a lot of people being treated as machines and sort of being the assistant to the machines. So it's a pretty bleak landscape. And you also just see, like, you know, plumes of pesticides and, you know, so.
Kind of the industrial model. Eliza, what about you? Do you see, you know, do you see a future in our food where we're going to be without farmers? I think we would be forced to eat, you know, those kinds of industrial foods that come in brilliantly colored packages and sit on the grocery shelf for 3 years without spoiling. Do you see that in our future?
You know, I was just at the Future Farmers of America National Conference last month, where the, you know, rural kids from across the country are being told, how are you going to feed 9 billion people by 2050? The answers are genetically modified crops and a system that's built on inputs. And really, that needs to become a news topic, because they're missing the point of whole systems considerations, where we need to live and work in harmony with nature in our food system in order to have a world to live in, and have, and so it's hopefully we won't be living off of corn subsidies and soybean subsidies in the future. Hopefully we can turn the tables and create a system where farming is returned to the people and is returned to the land, and it's just a responsible situation.
Well, you know, that industrial model of which you speak is made possible largely by substituting the input of time or people with the input of money that you can be used to buy equipment and buy chemicals. And so you get rid of the people and you use the less expensive input of money, and because you can always borrow money. And so it would seem like that industrial model is going to be a tough one to overcome without farmers who are willing to spend the time. Okay, so where are we going to find the farmers who are going to be willing to spend the time? Now, Lauren, in your article, The New Farmers, in Orion Magazine, I noticed that you did not go to the conventional places to find new farmers, places like the Future Farmers of America, 4-H clubs, schools of agriculture, land-grant colleges. Why didn't you?
It's a great question, and the answer is not it's not that I'm not interested in those places or those sources of farmers. I'm tremendously interested in sort of all aspects of the agricultural industry, small and large. For the purposes of this article, what I was really interested, it was almost like a personal question, which was, you know, answering this personal question of why are so many of my friends and my contemporaries who are in many ways, you know, have really, like me, you know, have really similar educational backgrounds, were not raised in farming. Why are those people going into farming? And so I was interviewing, frankly, people more like me, who are people who come from a more privileged education background, a more privileged upbringing. That, for the purposes of this article, was my question. That is not to say that those other sources and stories are not vitally important.
Do you think your friends who are going into agriculture have as their central interest the responsibility of feeding everybody?
No, actually, I don't think that they have a central interest of, you know, the responsibility, the sort of weighing on their shoulders of feeding everybody. I think actually what they have on their shoulders is maybe an even bigger question, which is like how to feed more people in a more sustainable way, and a way in a system that does not completely devastate the earth as we know it.
Eliza, with respect to the greenhorns and the young people that you bring in and work to train in agriculture, why do you not go to like the conventional sources of human talent, like Future Farmers and whatnot, to find that future for us?
Well, the Future Farmers of America is a system built largely on monoculture. And just with given my background, given the fact that diversity is always key in anything you do, and also moderation is key. You know, I sort of have repelled this idea of monoculture, this idea of having pest attack just one crop, you know, and also mutate to avoid other, you know, all inputs that you put in order to kill them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not a sustainable method of agriculture. And the greenhorns are there to sort of just promote the diversity of agriculture, to promote the fact that, you know, I mean, vegetables and fruit growing to people like the FSA are considered specialty crops. You know, it's not even your potatoes, you know, that you're putting on the table. It's just something that's a supplement to the corn and soybean nation that we've become. And so, yeah, with the greenhorns, we're here to sort of spread the gospel of diversity and trying to get as many farmers as we can to farm in more sustainable, more holistic and more regenerative practices.
Okay, so Well, we're going to go to the phones when we come back from this upcoming break, and perhaps we can find a farmer or two out there who will help us find new farmers. We have our break coming up. Okay, so we have a break coming up. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Folks, we're looking at some amazing trends, the big trend being the fact that our farmers are aging out of the business of farming. They're 58 years of age right now. Holy smokes. And farming is a mentally and physically demanding occupation. It requires smart people and healthy people. And when we get to be 58 years of age, we start looking for a way to move back a little bit. So who's going to step into those shoes? Who's going to be the young folks who are going to take over the tremendous responsibility of feeding the nation? And what an incredible responsibility that is. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. To the phones. When we get back, do stay tuned.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids, but the college years at UC Davis were the big years because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Who is going to step into the shoes of our farmers to feed us? That's the question on the table today. With us to help answer that question, we have Lauren Markham, who is the author of The New Farmers, an article in Orion Magazine. You can read it yourself at orionmagazine.org. Also with us, Eliza Greenman, who is with the Greenhorn Organization. They help populate the world with new farmers. And there seems to be a lot of organizations and a lot of people who are offering training, apprenticeships, and whatnot throughout the land. So who knows? Maybe we'll find those new farmers. So we're going to go to the phones right now. The number is 800-624-2665 and 831-479-1080. We're going to see what the audience has to say about who is going to step into those shoes. We'll start with Tom. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, good morning. So, yeah, I kind of disagree with the analysis of the situation because what's happening is that because of technology and because of the American consumer, we need fewer farmers to grow the food because of the level of efficiency. So there's a continuing consolidation, and that's going to continue because the consumers voted. And they voted for Costco, and they voted for Walmart, and this, that, and the other thing. And the supply chain feeds into that. And that's going to be large scale. And then you've got the regulatory overhead that the smaller farm operations just can't absorb that regulatory, the management of the administrative overhead on a small-scale operation. The margins aren't there.
I have a quick question before you move on with that. May I ask you this? I often thought that 85% of the regulations put forward by government are designed to restrict trade. How would you respond?
Yeah, well, I don't know so much about that. I mean, I think California is unique because, you know, we're the only state in the country that has its own EPA and, you know, aside from the federal level. And it's so complex and so capital intensive to do anything in this state in terms of investment in agriculture that it requires large organizations to do it. And then what you end up with is larger and larger farming operations that are employing specialists. So you've got an irrigation specialist, a fertility specialist, you've got a pest control specialist. And so the whole model of, you know, you've got this farmer that's got everything in his head, you know, an expert at everything, and he's running his operation. I mean, that model is fundamentally, it's changed, and it's, you know, we're never going to go back, you know, until we change the whole supply chain, right?
Well, this is really good one. I love this one, Tom. Let's throw this to our guests here and see what they have to say. Lauren and Eliza, let's see. Tom says that it's just too big now and too complex for small farmers. Lauren, we want to start with you.
Yes. I mean, Eliza has much more expertise in this, so I'm really interested to hear what she says. But what I will say, and sort of my reactions are that, you know, this idea of this sort of, you know, invisible hand, consumers have made the choice. I mean, I don't think consumers always have the education, and I feel personally as a consumer, someone who's not involved in agriculture except for now writing about it, that I my choices are limited by the system. So it's not that I've chosen the system, it's that the system is inherently limiting my choices. I will also say that it's kind of amazing that we've gone through 48 minutes of a radio show in California about agriculture, and we haven't talked about the drought. The fact is that California is operating on complete borrowed time. We're draining our groundwater system. We don't have enough water. I was just in Fresno this week, and the cantaloupe capital of the world, Mendota, California, is reducing its cantaloupes because they're too water intensive. So, you know, this idea that it's like, oh, it's more efficient. It's, you know, it not always. And what is that going to be true when we run out of water?
Eliza, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that we've built a system where efficiency is equal to sort of, it's equal to the amount of waste, or it's equal to the amount of inputs we're putting in. And that's not sustainable. And so what I see is the crux of this is that it's awareness. It's awareness of educating people about where their food comes from, because this caller has mentioned Costco as setting an example for, I think perhaps price of food, and also the availability of food. And really, we're working backwards from that system now, where we're working towards connecting farmers and communities with food sovereignty and so people, we're all learning together. People are learning how their food is grown. They're learning the ethics behind it. They're learning what real efficiency means. They're learning what diversity means. And so that's only a matter of time. You know, it's just, we've got to educate. We've got to start being more vocal and just get in the streets and telling people why we grow this food, why we're excited about growing this food, and how it positively affects you and your community.
Tom, you got the last word there.
Well, I guess I'd just say, I mean, that's good, but in terms of, you know, if you're 20 or 30 years old, you've got a degree in ag, and came from a farm family, and you're looking at a career window of 20 years or 25 years, you got to look at the reality on the ground today and where your skills are going to bring the most return back to your family and, you know, your future. And maybe there's big changes in the system in the future, but right now it is what it is, and that's what we got to deal with. So that's
can I say something really fast?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure. Thanks, Tom.
So I've looked into some statistics about this, and from cash receipts from 1985 to now, the subsidy based agriculture has increased 14%. From the non-subsidy-based agriculture, it's increased 187%
Wow. Between
1985 and now. So what we're really doing, these farmers...
Hold that thought. We've got to take a quick break. Right back, folks. Do stay tuned. Back to the phones and you. Right back.
Hello.
Well, holy smokes, so much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in. Eliza, you have a stunning statistic there that you brought up at the end of the last segment. Would you please restate that?
Sure. So between 1985 and today, the subsidized farmers, in terms of cash receipts, have increased by 14%. And non-subsidized farmers, their profits have increased by 187% since 1985, and those are statistics by the Cato Institute.
So, thus describing essentially a shift we see going on. Something else is happening, and it would seem to be in it's happening big time in the world of agriculture that is not being subsidized by the federal government.
That's correct. And I think a lot of that has to do with public awareness, and it has to do with people starting to catch hold to what they eat and what they need from a nutritional standpoint for their daily diet.
Wayne, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the food chain. Fire away.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm a farmer now. I'm 52, and I was in the FFA program as a kid. You know, a lot of us all were inspired to become farmers, and so a lot of us here in Salinas Valley ended up coming back into farming. But over the years, there's been a lot of horizontal consolidation going on, and we can relate that to pretty much it's become more and more difficult to farm. Yeah, I'm one of those people, you know, we get together with my fellow farmer and we laugh and joke about it, you know, because there's so much that's happened over the past 30 years, starting with the Ag Commissioner, with the pesticide permits, and then, you know, later came the food safety, LGMA things we had to comply with. Now the Water Board has come in on water quality. They want to regulate our nitrate use, or they want to oversee our water use. You know, and we think it's another damn business how much fertilizer.
Let me ask you this. I ask Wayne this too. Don't you think a lot of these rules and regulations, if not designed to, are actually relating to the fact that only the very, 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 very big will be able to comply with them? Like only one or two farmers will be allowed to exist by virtue of the rules and regulations facing agriculture? Talk about horizontal integration. Don't you think we're going to be facing a world in which there are only going to be like three farmers allowed to farm?
Well, it's what's happening more and more. And you know, with the land rents keep jacking up more and more, the land rents, who the heck a young guy can get into this business no more? You know, and with all the regulations that I described going on, and plus the it's harder and harder to find good people to come out and do the jobs. There's not enough workers in the crews. They don't let us put, you know, labor camps are a dirty word, so any type of housing for the people, there's not enough places to put them, for them to live. No wonder we can't get enough to work out here.
Well,
but, you know, with all this stuff going on, we talk to each other, we laugh, we say, yeah, who the hell's going to do this damn job someday when we quit? And who's going to want to do this job someday?
Eliza, how are the young farmers going to cope with all of those rules and regulations designed to restrict giants?
Well, I don't know if restriction is a good word to use with all of this. These rules and regulations are based basically on the amount of resources that we have and, you know, the quality of health of the people around
us. Yeah, but
us.
How are the young people going to comply with the rules designed for the giant people?
Oh, how are you going to comply with the rules designed for the giant people? Well, it's a little bit of a fight, for sure, because they are running, rules and regulations.
We're running out of time, doggone it. Eliza, thank you for joining us. Eliza Greenham from the... Greenman from the Greenhorns. Yeah. Green Man from the Greenhorns. Got it. Lauren Markham, author of The New Farmers in Orion Magazine. Check out it. You can read it yourself at orionmagazine.com. Thank you all for tuning in. Sorry I missed you on the phone.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.